Blue-collar workers used to be a solid part of the American middle class. But today, blue-collar jobs are disappearing fast, and industries like logistics, moving goods to and from trailers, are providing cheap labor. But the pay is low, the work is tough, and the job security is non-existent. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, in this week for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we take a look at the erosion of labor rights in America and the effect it has on poverty. Our guest this hour is Dave Jamieson. He's the Huffington Post workplace reporter. His most recent article is called The New Blue Collar, Temporary Work, Lasting Poverty, and the American Warehouse. And we'd love to know what you think. What's taking the place of those old blue-collar industries? And with continued high unemployment, are people accepting tougher working conditions, whether in warehouses, mines, factories, or elsewhere, rather than risk joining the ranks of the jobless? And what's happening, then, with the effect on poverty in America? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Dave Jamieson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Well, America has kind of sailed by for decades on this notion that hard work will earn you a living, that the opportunities are going to be there if you're ambitious enough. But judging by your article, that's getting less and less true, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, we're obviously in a hard time right now. This has been a very difficult economy for a few years now. And, I think there are a lot of workers out there. We've got an unemployment rate that's still around 8.6%. Folks are generally happy to have a job, grateful to have it if they're in that fortunate camp. And so I think a lot of folks at this point are pretty much willing to settle. I mean, we've already seen that people who lost jobs and managed to get them back during this downturn are the vast majority of them are worse off now than they were a few years ago.
What about these blue-collar jobs that you write about? In one case, you talk about, or you quote a historian, a labor historian, who says that these logistics jobs should be the new steelworker jobs, that these should be the new industry, but it's not nearly as solid.
Right. What we've seen in the last few decades, obviously, as folks all over the country know, is, pretty much the loss of our manufacturing jobs. There's, relatively very little that we still make here in the U.S. The vast majority of our goods are coming now from Asia. Those manufacturing jobs used to be very good, solid jobs that were a ladder into the middle class. What we need now are new sectors that can replace a lot of those jobs, and that's supposed to be the service industry, which is strong here, and other things that are driven by our consumer economy. One realm within that is as you said, the logistics industry. This is the movement of goods. We're a consumer economy. We buy lots and lots of stuff. And no matter what we do, no matter how many manufacturing jobs go overseas, we're going to need to bring these goods into our stores and get them to buyers. That's made this logistics industry, the goods movement, a very important industry in the last couple decades. But in a lot of cases, even though there are plenty of good jobs in that industry, there are a very large but unknown number of temporary jobs, very insecure jobs that are low-paying, that come without benefits, and really that don't get people into the middle class.
Well, and a lot of people are saying what we're witnessing now in terms of legislation and what we're seeing just on the ground in places like these logistics warehouses is an erosion of labor rights. So could you talk us through maybe one of the examples that you write about, one of the people you spoke with and what their life was like there?
Yeah, sure. I traveled to two places. One was Joliet, Illinois. The other was the Inland Empire area of Southern California. And I went to those two because those are the two largest, distribution areas in the country. The reason for that is in California, the goods are coming in from Asia, and they're coming into the ports in and around Los Angeles. And then a lot of those goods from there are headed to Joliet because Joliet is a major rail corridor. It's within, you know, a day's drive of two-thirds of the country. So if you're in the Midwest or even on the East Coast, there's a good chance your goods came through Joliet. Now, the logistics industry has really blown up in Joliet in the last and its surrounding areas in the last two decades. You know, one woman I spoke with there, Yolanda, she's like a lot of, you know, workers there, has been in and out of a bunch of warehouses over the years. Last year, she went to work in a warehouse that was moving goods for Walmart. Now, Walmart didn't run this warehouse. It was run by a company that Walmart contracts with called Schneider Logistics. But Yolanda didn't work even for Schneider Logistics. She worked for one of the agencies that Schneider contracted to. And this is something you see in a lot of warehouses where there's going to be several different companies between the worker at the bottom and whatever company is at the top of the food chain. And the work is very hard. She was a woman doing a job that isn't very common for a woman in the warehouse. She's what's known as a lumper. A lumper is somebody who is basically loading and unloading boxes off of trailers in the warehouse all day long. And when people say lumper, they're usually talking about often a temporary worker. So Yolanda was loading and unloading boxes all day for about a year. Very difficult job, very stressful. You have supervisors, she says, who are you know, constantly telling you to keep up the pace. You get a certain amount of breaks each day to you know, have your lunch or go to the bathroom or whatever it is. But these warehouses are so large that it could take 5 minutes to walk from one end to the other. So she wound up with these very short breaks, and she found she didn't feel she had the latitude to go to the bathroom exactly whenever she needed to. And she said she eventually developed a bladder infection. And this was a very difficult, stressful time for her. She had, says, you know, as a woman in there, it was very difficult. She was dealing with male coworkers and their come-ons and whatnot. Eventually, she just stopped showing up. You know, this was not a very well-paying job for a lot of the time. She was actually being paid according to piece rate, which is in a lot of different industries, you're paid, you know, according to the units you perform rather than the hours of work you do.
Mm-hmm.
So she had this, you know, was getting this very confusing paycheck where she really didn't know what it was going to look like at the end of the week, although it usually wasn't very much. And the piece rate work is something I've heard from a lot of different workers at this point, and it's something that seems to have become more common in the last few years, maybe perhaps due to the downturn. But it's a squeeze that workers feel. And you know, what's tough is as a temp, you know, if you're working on a temp basis, if you get hurt, you know, that's pretty much the end of your gig. You know, you're working without health benefits often, and you're pretty much working at the employer's pleasure. So if they feel you're not doing your job, you're out of a job, and you really have very little recourse.
So what's happened in that industry that there are not, you know, some protections in place for these workers?
Well, there are protections in place. The problem is enforcing them. You know, the workers there are you know, generally going to be subject to the same protections that most of us are, you know, under fair labor standards. You know, you've got to be paid for the work that you did. You got to be paid the minimum wage. And you got to be paid overtime. The problem is, especially when you're paid according to piece rate, is the pay becomes very, very confusing. And the larger problem is that the line of subcontracting in a lot of these situations makes it kind of hard to hold people accountable. You know, there's been a bunch of lawsuits in these warehouses in the last couple of years. You know, one very interesting one popped up about 2 months ago in California. This was at a warehouse also operated by Schneider, the Walmart subcontractor, where workers said they had been switched to a piece rate plan about a year and a half ago. They claimed they were told at the time, we're going to, you know, move you on to this different pay system where you're going to be paid more. It's going to be great. They say their pay actually dropped. So they're now suing a couple of the temp agencies and the operator, saying that they're that basically this new rate pushed their wages below the minimum wage, that they weren't getting overtime. There are certain recourses, mostly in terms of lawsuits. If you can find a lawyer who's going to go to bat for you if you feel you've been shorted on your wages. But the problem is in accountability. In that California case, a lot of these workers and labor activists, tend to feel that Walmart should be the one to make sure that workers are paid what they're owed and that they're paid fairly. But,
Walmart kind of says, well, these guys don't work for us.
That's exactly it. That's exactly, sort of the heart of this is accountability or the lack of it up and down the supply chain, because when these things, when these stories crop up, workers say there are problems. You have Walmart at the top saying, none of these guys are employed by us. And, you go down to the next line in the chain to Schneider, they say none of these folks work for us. You got to talk to these temp agencies. And then, you talk to these temp agencies and their agencies that you or I have never heard of. All the contracting, in addition to any cost saving that may come for the company at the top, corporations also get indemnified through it, because you end up with all these corporate middlemen and a whole bunch of finger pointing. And this isn't just in the warehouse industry. We've seen this in a lot of factory style jobs in food plants and food packing. There was a mini scandal at Hershey over the summer, which we can go into. But we've also seen it in other industries, even the hotel industry.
Can we draw a line here between the problem you're talking about and the diminishing power of labor unions?
We absolutely can. The American labor movement is at a bit of a low point right now. The latest figures, I think it's around between 7 and 8% of non-government American workers are unionized. I think it's around 12% if you lump in state and federal workers. Unions are generally not very powerful right now, and the way this ties into all the subcontracting is when you have this huge splintered workforce that's divvied up among all these different logistics companies, say, and all these different temp agencies, it becomes really, really difficult to organize. Because rather than dealing with, one big corporation like Walmart, which, as we've all seen, can fend off, a union itself as well as anyone, these people are having to deal with and bargain with, too many temp agencies than you can even count. So it becomes very difficult. A couple years ago, out in Joliet, Bissell, a vacuum manufacturer, they had temps in their warehouse. These temps were trying to organize. They'd gotten with the electrical workers union, and once that became apparent, suddenly the temp agency was dropped. So it becomes very, very easy for a corporation when they're using contracts like this to avoid unionization in their workplace. And so there's some organizing efforts going on both now in Illinois and out in California, but I think the obstacles are tremendous. It would be a years and years long effort.
So we've got this diminished blue collar job market going on right now. We've got the erosion of labor unions. Can you tie that all in together with us for what the impact of that is on the economy?
Yeah, well, the impact on the economy, you can see it very clearly in Joliet. You have a substantial workforce. It's hard to pin down the exact number because once these temps get involved, the data becomes really unclear. But you have a huge workforce. And a considerable chunk of it, even though they're working, is making very little money. A lot of these folks are tracking the minimum wage, often for years on end. So, they're not earning a lot of money, and these are Joliet residents. And so they're getting these weak paychecks every week or two. And because, you know, 2 decades ago, a warehouse job, a lot of these folks, you know, it may have been a union job, a lot of these folks would have been earning twice what they are now, a couple decades ago. So, you know, that's money that's not going in these folks' pockets, and that's money that in a lot of cases, wherever it's going, is not getting pumped back into the local economy. A lot of it's probably leaving the area. A lot of this money ends up, a lot of the savings that are reaped through this system of subcontracting, it goes to developers or in a lot of cases, it's going to go to Wall Street. So again, that's money that's not getting pumped into the local economy, and it's not making the local economy stronger. And that's an argument that's the larger scale economic argument that labor activists are going to make for why these jobs, whether in an industry like logistics, why they should be better jobs, why they should pay more, and why folks should have a living wage with benefits.
Well, and in terms of helping people get above the poverty line, it becomes a lot more difficult when the jobs aren't paying what they used to or providing the benefits, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. If you're earning, $9 an hour, say, in Illinois, that is, it's better than minimum wage, but it's well below what would be considered a living wage in an urban area like Chicago, which Joliet is basically part of. When you have workers who are temping in perpetuity like this, you basically get nowhere over the course of years. And I've talked to a lot of workers in plenty of different industries. Another example would be housekeepers in the hospitality industry. A lot of whom are these days are working through labor agencies rather than directly for hotels. And years and years can go by where you're basically tracking the minimum wage, if you're lucky enough to see a bump in the minimum wage. And so really, over time, in real terms, your wage is going to go down if you're not seeing steady advancement. And I've talked to a lot of folks in different cities who, 15 years later feel like they're making less now, and that their money doesn't go as far now as it did back in the 90s. And that's a huge problem for working class folks.
Dave Jamieson is our guest this hour. He is the Huffington Post workplace reporter, and we're talking about his most recent article, which ran yesterday. It's called The New Blue Collar, Temporary Work, Lasting Poverty, and the American Warehouse. And we're wondering about people accepting tougher working conditions and maybe getting less traction in terms of their own pocketbook when they're working these kinds of jobs, whether they're warehouse jobs, mines, factories. Are people doing these jobs rather than risk joining the ranks of the jobless? And what's happening in turn with the middle class? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're joined by Dave Jamieson. He is the Huffington Post workplace reporter. We're talking about his recent article called The New Blue Collar. And we'll take our first call right now. We have Art joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi. Thanks for having this guest on. I'm an employment lawyer. I've represented workers for many years. And by the way, I have heard a little bit about the Hershey situation, so I hope you do go into that before the hour is over. But the reason I was calling is more of a macro question, which is that over the years we've seen with technology, et cetera, a really sharp rise in productivity and what any one person can produce. And you would think that that would mean that people should be able to get more money and work fewer hours, and the next generation should be more and more prosperous than what we've had before, and instead it looks like we're looking at the opposite. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that. I did raise this concern with my son, who's living in Germany and back visiting, and he said, well, you know, it's not so much that the wealth is going up to the fat cats or whatever, but, you know, the wealth is, like, going around the world, so, like, you know, people in China are getting more of the wealth that otherwise we would have, which I don't think is right, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Okay, thank you so much, Art. Dave?
Yeah, thanks, Art. That's a great point about technology, and the logistics industry is a great example of this. The industry, what they can do is really, it's kind of dazzling. You know, the way we used to get retail goods is, you know, you'd make your you know, manufacturer would make it. It would sit in a factory outside the city, and then you'd go out and sell it and try to bring it into the city. Now, you know, these retailers know exactly what they want, where they're getting it, and they're all getting it, you know, pretty much the same stuff from Asia. You know, so the trick is in moving it as quickly as possible. And even the word warehouse these days is kind of a misnomer because we don't really house things anymore. The idea is really to not house them, is to keep them moving from the port to the rail to the store display. You know, now, you know, these warehouses are actually, they're actually called cross docks now, where they're literally, they're coming in one side of the warehouse and moving right out the other, barely touching the ground. And so when you have that kind of remarkable efficiency and cost saving, yeah, you'd think, you know, that would generally be a good thing for everybody. And it does, it helps lower prices. But the bottom line is, you know, you can't automate everything in a warehouse. And you know, you're always going to need bodies in there moving this stuff. And so the huge emphasis on cost cutting and efficiency in a lot of ways, you know, can come at the cost of the folks who still have to be in there moving the goods. You know, the retailers are you know, incredibly sophisticated in how they move this stuff. You know, from what I understand, you know, they've basically got algorithms going, you know, figuring out, you know, where they want these goods going through, you know, which warehouses they should be going on to next. But, you know, all that technology and brilliance, you know, in a lot of cases is not helping the workers at the bottom who still need to pull the boxes out of the truck, get them in the warehouse and load them back onto the truck. They don't seem to be benefiting a whole lot from all the technological advancement.
And what about Art's other question that he got into with his son about the wealth not just going to the Wall Street people, but going around the world?
Yeah, you know, that's just that's part of the global economy. You know, and this logistics industry is really at, you know, right smack in the middle of that. You know, as I said, all of these things are coming from Asia now, all these products. And so you know, the money that's you know, the money here is really, like Art said, is going, you know, all over the world, not just to Wall Street. That's just kind of the fact of our new globalized world, and you know, what we have to do here in America is figure out a way to you know, to still have good working class middle class jobs within this new globalized world.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Art. And we'll move next to Raj joining us from Madison. Hi, Raj.
Hi. One of the impacts of the condition that your guest is talking about is one on education and students. I came to this country as a 17-year-old immigrant in 1952, and I was able to work my way through college with my classmates and I by working part-time during the school year and full-time during the summer in manufacturing jobs or farm jobs or whatever. There were lots of jobs available. Nowadays, our students don't have that option, with one consequence being that the vast majority of graduates from state universities end up with a fairly high level of debt when they're graduating. Here in Madison, I think on average, the average student has $25,000 of debt, and they finish and they can't find a job. In my day, it was possible. It's partly, I think, because of the dramatic increase in the tuition at state universities, because until the 1980s, when Reagan introduced the notion that those who benefit from the education should pay for it, state universities were willing to cover most of the tuition. They don't do that anymore, and the students have to work to try to, you know, achieve that. But the fact that it is almost impossible to get a decent job during the summer that pays the kind of wage that would enable a student to cover his tuition. It is, again, I think one of the consequences of the dramatic change in the labor situation in this country.
Great. Some interesting points there, Raj. Dave?
As Raj said, it's getting, really, really expensive to go to school these days and to get your degree. And one thing we need to figure out is, especially for people who can't afford it, is you know, what they're supposed to do, especially for people without college educations these days. As we said earlier, with manufacturing, with all those jobs heading overseas, we've kind of eroded the base of good, solid middle class jobs for people who happen to not have educations. And that's, again, this goes back to problems, for example, that we were saying earlier in this logistics industry, where these are jobs that are, many of them are skilled. You have to develop skills to do them. They're difficult jobs. But despite all that, a lot of these jobs are not paying living wages. This is a problem where in this economy, we hear so much about this, this skills gap of employers saying, with these blue collar jobs, I have these job openings, but I can't find the people who do them. These people they don't have the skills to do them. And so these jobs are lying vacant. But we have to figure out a way to get people back into those jobs. And I think in a lot of cases, employers are saying, well, there aren't bodies out there to do this. But I think, employers should be more willing to train people in the way that they used to. And I know, states at this point, they feel there's such a problem with the skills gap that they're looking to revive, even apprenticeship programs. We need to find a way to get people without educations, into decent working class jobs, the way they were there 20, 30 years ago.
And how do we go about that?
That's a great question. It's probably above my pay grade. the apprenticeship programs are a nice thing to see these days.
Well, there have been some articles and some books recently saying that there's too much emphasis on going to college, period, and that we need to restore some dignity to working with your hands, to jobs that aren't necessarily that come out of a college education. Is that part of it?
I think so. College, it's just these kids are coming out with such a huge load of debt right now, a lot of them, there aren't even jobs there in their given fields. I've talked to a lot of kids coming out of law school with tremendous debt hanging over their head, and many of them, having regretted even going into it. I think we do need, more jobs that people can do with their hands. The trouble is, again, a lot of this goes back to the evaporation of our manufacturing base. The service sector is one of our strongest sectors, service and retail. The problem is a lot of those jobs simply are not paying the wages that people need to get by, especially in retail. That it's through this whole through the downturn and the slow recovery. Retail has, often been one of the bright spots in the monthly jobs reports. The problem is a lot of that work is seasonal and, frankly, pretty low paying.
I want to go to an email next. This is from Gary in Iron River, who says, "It seems to me it is fair to conclude that much of the cost savings finds its way to a reduced cost for the items, which results in everyone seeing the savings and making money available to spend on something else or pay off bills. This might not be right and good, but most of us benefit from these reduced costs by shopping at Walmart. and Target instead of the local private drugstore or clothing store or whatever. Don't just say it goes to Wall Street.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. You know, and when you talk to Walmart about why they would, outsource a lot of their work, they'll tell you frankly that it's about cutting costs and delivering lower prices to consumers. And yes, we do benefit from that, or we feel we benefit from it. The problem is a lot of that benefit, you know, could be sort of illusory. The middle class is despite these really low prices that we get comparatively on just about everything we buy, the middle class is by many measures shrinking. A report came out recently showing that from 2001 to 2007, excuse me, was the first period of economic growth where workers were worse off at the end of it than they were at the beginning. And so even though we have these low prices that seem to get continuously lower and lower, we have to wonder why the middle class itself, despite all that benefit in the consumer economy, doesn't seem to be advancing.
What's interesting about that statistic you just said is that those years, 2001 to 2007, those were growth years for the economy.
Exactly. Yeah, we're not talking about the recession. We're talking about positive growth years. But wages for much of the middle class in real terms happen to shrink in that time. Why exactly that is, I'm not an economist. I can't say. But when we look at low prices, we have to wonder what the net benefits are when the middle class in general doesn't seem to be benefiting all that much from them.
Well, thank you much for that email, Gary. And moving to Bill in Madison next. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I'm going to use a company that everyone knows about as an example, but I think this goes throughout the economy. General Motors, who was recently bailed out with big loans from Uncle Sugar, U.S. taxpayer, in order to be able to shed its pensions and shed a lot of wage costs and old fat that arguably shouldn't have been there, but they don't really care about the American middle class anymore. In the old days, they did because they were the ones who bought their cars. But General Motors has announced that they sell more cars in China now than they sell in the U.S. So they've really, I think, written off the American middle class. They really don't care what happens to the American middle class anymore because their market is in the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, China, and Korea, they no longer care about us. And so I think that's part of what's happening, too. There's a lot of American companies who just no longer see any positive benefit to even keeping a middle class in the U.S. I'd like your guest reactions to that.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Bill. And Dave.
Yeah, I can understand the frustration there. GM and Detroit in general is kind of on good footing now. We're seeing the resurgency of that industry. By many people, was a highly criticized bailout, turns out to look like a pretty good thing. Despite all that, the automakers and the unions have hit some agreements recently. But, from what I understand, that there was some unhappiness among, rank and file, in the auto union over, there's a feeling that these jobs aren't as going to be as good as they used to be. The pay and benefits aren't going to be there. It's probably going to move more to the model we see in the South, where some of the Asian auto manufacturers have put factories in, where those states are very happy to have those jobs, but they're certainly not the kinds of jobs that we saw in old Detroit. Very, very strong middle class jobs where people could make really good livings. I mean, those jobs at those plants in the South are good jobs. I'm just saying that they're not the very good jobs that we saw in Detroit. And so I think generally, especially when you talk about the auto industry in America, a lot of people are kind of recalibrating their expectations of what a good auto manufacturing job is. because in this new economy and with this new auto industry, you know, they're not going to quite be at the same level that they used to be.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that call. And we're talking this hour with Dave Jamieson. He is the Huffington Post workplace reporter. And we're talking about the decline of the blue-collar job market and the effect on the economy, the effect on poverty as well. His most recent article is called The New Blue Collar: Temporary Work, Lasting Poverty, and the American Warehouse. And we're curious to hear what you think this morning about the decline of the blue-collar job and what it means also in conjunction with the decline of labor rights as well. Our number, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also shoot us an email at talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in This Week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on today on Wisconsin Public Radio, join us for Chapter a Day at 12:30 as Carl Schmidt reads from An Irish Country Christmas by Patrick Taylor. This hour, we're talking with Dave Jamieson. He is the Huffington Post workplace reporter. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, talking about the decline of the blue-collar job industry and what that means for the economy and people's pocketbooks as well. We'll take our next call now. We've got Jack joining us from Pewaukee. Hey, Jack.
Good morning. Thank you for this valuable article, David. I want to mention to you a corollary from the construction industry. I'm an engineer who's involved in construction defect litigation and quality control. And what we see is similar to what we've seen in the warehouse industry. Let's call it Sam's Drywall Company, which 5 years ago had 32 employees. Sam now has one. And he has 31 temporary drywall installers. Sam has saved a lot of money, and he's stayed competitive in a difficult industry. But the problem that I'm seeing is with the lack of the apprenticeship programs, the lack of training, the lack of continuous jobs, we are seeing incredibly decreasing quality in the construction industry. We are having buildings where we come in and we simply say, tear all the siding off, tear all the brick off, everything is wrong, the roofs are leaking. So not only have we depressed the wages of the people involved in the industry, but the productivity has actually decreased. In the warehouses, you have the algorithms on the part of the managers that made sure that things work. The construction industry is not so organized, and so what we are finding is devolution into chaos. Might be an interesting place for you to do a follow-up article. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Jack. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, that's thanks, Jack. That's really interesting. Drywall is not something that had occurred to me as something that could be outsourced. But of course, anything can be outsourced. That example shows, you know, how many industries this has spread to. And Sam's Drywall, which I assume is fictitious, you know, there are a lot of incentives for Sam's Drywall to go from 32 direct hired employees to one and outsource the rest through some drywall installing agency. And one reason is that Sam's Drywall, if they do that, they're no longer going to have to worry about how much they pay workers, what kind of benefits they give them, or paying into workman's comp or all these things that are sort of the traditional responsibilities of being an employer in America. Instead, they can foist that off on somebody else, onto an agency that's probably a little less scrutinized and not quite as well known in the community. So as Jack said, not surprised to hear that he would feel that there's been a decrease in quality in that, because, you know, through the outsourcing, through the subcontracting, you wind up the folks at the bottom are getting paid less, and so they're less invested in their jobs. And in these situations, you have tremendous turnover, and that goes for a lot of industries, certainly the warehousing and logistics industry as well. You know, I talked to folks who said, you know, most workers, they saw them for 3 months max. And so there's this tremendous churn going on, and a lot of that is facilitated by this outsourcing temp model.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, and we'll move next to Glenn in Amberg. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The thing I'd like to address is, and I don't hear it talked about much, is the fact that we've really given our markets away. We've given them away. We've entered into these free trade agreements, not fair trade, free trade. And there's no way we can compete. We can't compete with 50 cents an hour, a lack of environmental issues in other countries. They take away our, don't use our patents and our copyrights. I think if the situation was reversed, China would shut us off in a minute. And I don't think we should get out of trade, but I think it should be you buy so much from us, we buy so much from you. I'd like to hear his comment on that.
Okay, thank you.
That's a frustration I hear fairly regularly. When we talk about free trade, it's there's very few people who are on the free trade bandwagon when you talk about free trade agreements. You know, we've seen these pending agreements with Colombia and South Carolina that have been. We're sitting there for years, but even at this point, President Obama feels, has been trying to move them along. Regardless of which side of the aisle on, there's a general agreement that these free trade agreements are a good thing. Labor unions and some others feel otherwise. You know, they've strongly, opposed these kinds of agreements. And basically, after NAFTA, the data, it gets spun either way, whichever side you're sitting on this. A lot of folks feel that these free trade agreements are a loss for the working class, even though they may benefit a lot of big multinationals. And years down the road, we may be able to see, exactly what comes out of these new free trade agreements.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And I want to go back to something a caller mentioned, you yourself had mentioned earlier as well. You said there was a situation at the Hershey plant. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Over the summer, there was a situation, a big high-profile walkout at a plant in Pennsylvania where workers were handling Hershey products. And it turns out all these workers were guest workers from Eastern Europe and Asia. They were students. And they were here on J-1 visas. These are guest worker visas administered by the State Department. And it was a very interesting situation where you had this huge walkout of kids from overseas. And a lot of people didn't realize it, but these folks had been packing and handling, the Hershey products that we all buy. And what they walked out over were what they claimed were abusive working conditions. They said that, these kids that had come from overseas for the summer, they had paid a lot of money to get here. There were administrative costs in getting their visas. And they said they ended up working for low wages under very harsh conditions. They said they were lifting 50-pound boxes throughout the day, and that they were told if they slowed down or couldn't do the work that they were going to get deported. And a lot of these kids said that when they did the math, because of the administrative costs and the housing costs that were deducted, that at the end of the day, they were barely breaking even on this whole thing and claimed they were basically just supplying labor here. So, the situation, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier with all the subcontracting, none of these kids worked for Hershey. They worked for a labor supplier, which was contracted to somebody who was contracted to Hershey. And this, as in logistics, this is a situation we've seen in food packing and in plant work like this, where there's a bunch of different corporate players, in the building, and many of them, pointing figures when abusive allegations pop up. And now this is something that's being investigated by the State Department. They claim they're going to be, they say they're going to have to scrutinize this program more and take a closer look at the folks who the companies and nonprofits that broker these J-1 visas. But in the larger picture, this story, this Hershey situation infuriated a lot of people in eastern Pennsylvania. And that's because the Hershey jobs used to be really good jobs, you know, once upon a time. The union there, the chocolate workers union, is from my understanding, very tiny these days. And sort of those good working class Hershey jobs have kind of eroded into a situation where not only is it, low wage, but it's not even, a Pennsylvanian who's working in there. It's some kid from Asia who is on this whirlwind tour of America, and that's what they go home with. That's the impression.
So that's so interesting. So I guess presumably those kids are there because Hershey saves money by not hiring just straight out hiring their own workers and paying the benefits.
One might think, they're there ostensibly, amazingly, under the premise of cultural exchange. But for why Hershey would do that, you would have to ask Hershey. But my guess is that they save money by doing that, and by contracting the work out to some logistics company or packing company. They put it on them as to where they're going to get the workers and what those workers are going to be paid, and then that company can find another company to worry about it, and on down the line it goes until. At the bottom, in a lot of cases, you're going to have workers who aren't being paid very much, and several corporate players who've gotten a cut on its way down the line.
Do you think legislation could be part of the answer here, saying that companies have to be accountable to their workers if they're, in essence, working for that company?
That's a great question. I can't imagine we'd ever see anything on the federal level, but there have been some efforts on the state level. In Illinois, for example, because of this explosion in temp work surrounding the logistics industry, they've got a new law. It's a year or two old on temp labor, where it stipulates all these things that temp companies have to do. They have to tell workers exactly the work they're going to be doing, what they're going to be paid for it, kind of what the assignment's going to be. But on top of that, the law technically holds other companies within the contracting chain accountable. If a mega retailer is at the top of that line, then in theory, by this law, they can be held responsible for any shenanigans at the bottom. I haven't seen any sort of big player get tied up into that, but it's not beyond reason.
Well, let's go back to our phone lines now. Gail joining us from Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When the one gentleman had phoned about the quality of construction going down, we're trying to get a storm door put on a door, and it's the third time now we're trying to get it adjusted and get the door parts and get it, and it's been three times now. There's still something missing, or there's something broken, or it's not fitting the way they're supposed to. This has been, and I asked the gentleman, and he said, well, a lot of the experienced guys are being like, oh, because they make more money, and then the new guys are there, so there's not the experience. And he's trying to work through the issue that the manufacturer is doing this. And it took me back to working in a corporation field back in the 80s and 90s, and through the 90s, it was all this outsourcing, and it was for the companies to eliminate that overhead for all the employees. Let somebody else do their profit sharing. Let somebody else do their health care benefit program. Let somebody else pay their vacations. Let somebody else pay for whatever, their salaries and whatever. They cut that out, so they just bought the services. They didn't have to take all of that other burden on. And that's how the corporations made it through the 90s. But now it's just getting totally out of hand. So I see the problem out there, and I'm really concerned on how they're going to fix that.
Okay. Thanks, Gail. And David?
Yeah. That's a really interesting point on experience. And just, as a corollary, of course, this is a different industry, but, I was recently in Indianapolis talking with hotel workers. And I was talking to a bellhop who he'd been in the industry 20 odd years. I was well known around town. His job, his whole bellhop crew at his hotel was outsourced. They had been direct hires of the hotel. They went with an agency.
that could supply workers for cheaper. And so, you know, what had been, you know, a very experienced crew of bellhops at this hotel was suddenly, you know, a bunch of young college kids. And you may think anyone can be a bellhop, but there are skills to it. There's things you got to know. You got to know how to deal with people. So among all the bitterness with that outsourcing, you know, there was a pervasive feeling that the quality had gone down, because suddenly you had a very young crop of inexperienced workers who were learning on the go, and because of the you know, surely the lower pay and the weaker benefits, you know, these were people who are less invested in making that a job or a career.
And I think we have to leave it there, Dave. We're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us this hour. It's been great.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Dave Jamieson, our guest this hour, the Huffington Post workplace reporter. His most recent article is called The New Blue Collar, Temporary Work, Lasting Poverty, and the American Warehouse. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning for answering your phone calls this hour and for her production of this hour as well. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.